The Global Story, with smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story, every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and this is Focus on Africa on the BBC World Service. Welcome to our conversations. Today we're talking about the African Union. How effective is it in dealing with the complexities of the continent? One of the commanders from Uganda's brutal war in the north is on trial. Who is he, and what is he accused of?
Thomas Kwoyelo was abducted earlier when he was young, and he himself participated in abductions of girls and boys whom they would eventually convert into combatants of the LRA. So he's accused of crimes against humanity.
And Zambia has become only the second country in the world to roll out a drug that helps prevent HIV infections. It's called PrEP. But how does it work?
This is where you use medicines or drugs to give people who are at a higher risk of HIV infection, so that in the event that they do get in contact with the virus does not sit in the blood.
So in effect, it's taking medicine before you get sick?
Yes.
It's Monday, the 19th of February. First, we go to Addis Ababa. The yearly African Union summit became the battleground for a diplomatic spat between Ethiopia and Somalia this weekend. The continent's leaders had gathered to talk about matters that concern the youth of the continent, specifically education. The chairman of the AU, Musa Faki Mahamat, had wanted to fix the minds of our leaders on ending conflicts and instability in light of recent coups in West Africa and also the continuing war in Sudan. His comments were echoed by Bankole Adeyoke, the Commissioner for Political Affairs and Peace and Security.
The need to address these threats and current rising of tension in many of our regions. It is important to also emphasize that all African leaders have continuously, consistently expressed concern at the trend of unconstitutional changes of government on the African continent.
But the summit was overshadowed by a dispute between Ethiopia and Somalia, with Somalia's president Hassan Sheikh Mohamud accusing Ethiopian security of trying to prevent him from entering the venue.
When I prepared myself to come and attend the closed session of the summit, the Ethiopian security blocked my way. They refused me to come out of the hotel and go on with my cars and entourage to come. It took me a long time to stay there, and at the end I come with another president's cars and entourage. And when we come to the African Union headquarters again, the president of the Republic of Djibouti and myself, again we were blocked to enter.
Alex Vines is head of the Africa program at the Chatham House think tank here in London. He had just come back from Addis Ababa when I spoke to him. So from the highlands of Ethiopia to South London, you're back.
You're too well informed, Audrey, I know that.
Well, I'm looking forward to your expertise. We're going to be talking about the African Union summit that's just ended. You were there, hence the reference to Ethiopia and back to South London. Firstly, in very general terms, the summit had a very particular focus and it was about education and so on. But what actually was discussed at the summit and what sort of took the headlines?
The reality was that the real conversations were all about what to do with non-constitutional changes of government, military coups in particular, what to do with some of the conflict hotspots, tensions between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, what's happening in Sudan. Those were the things that in the side meetings and in the corridors that people were really discussing.
We'll come to those shortly, but let's talk about the fracas that overshadowed the summit. Ethiopia and Somalia and Somaliland. We just heard Somalia's president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, saying that Ethiopian security tried to prevent him from entering the venue. That sounds like a very egregious kind of thing for any government to do. Did it happen?
It's unclear about entering the summit itself, but he arrived in Addis, the Somalia president, looking for a fight. He didn't stop to listen to the Ethiopian national anthem when he arrived after the Somali one was played. He just walked straight off. And the Somali government of Mogadishu is clearly very aggrieved by what's happening and wanted to grab headlines, which they effectively did, including making these allegations.
There is bad blood, though, isn't there, between Somalia and Ethiopia at the moment because of Ethiopia and Somaliland agreeing that Ethiopia should have access to a port. How does the AU actually deal with that kind of situation? How did it deal with it in this particular instance? Because Somaliland is not quite a recognized state.
Somaliland is not recognized by anybody so far. There is this leaked information that there is a memorandum that in exchange for Ethiopia getting a port access and lease, they will recognize Somaliland. I don't know if that will go ahead, although in Addis on Sunday, I went to look at the Somaliland diplomatic representation in Addis, and they have Somaliland embassy now in big brass plaques on their gate. So they clearly have ambitions in that direction. This is a really tough one for the African Union because a defining principle for the union is that the boundaries that exist should remain the same. There isn't particular enthusiasm across the continent for more fragmentation.
So the African Union has to deal with lots of contentious issues. And yet all these leaders, some of them having issues with each other, you know, between states. Can it properly mediate between states?
So in some cases they can and have done effectively with smaller states, but it did feel in Addis that at the moment, the African Union's authority and effectiveness is diminished.
Who listens to the AU?
That's such a good question, Audrey. Myself and lots of people came to Addis and we were there. And it is a way of African presidents trying to define a kind of pan-African vision. But it's very contradictory. As soon as those heads of state leave Addis, they become often much less pan-African and focused on their own countries or their immediate regions. So the African Union is in crisis, but so are the regional economic communities. It was sad to hear the African Union reflecting quite openly at times how they thought the economic community of West African states had messed up in West Africa with all the coups and that they could do better. I was left thinking, well, that's the pot calling the kettle black.
So let's talk about the African Union itself. What would you say were three successes briefly and three failures?
Well, the African Union has played some important mediation roles. It has at times been very draconian. For example, the Comoros Islands, it imposed very stifling sanctions, but realized that that had humanitarian impact and was able then to kind of row back and use good offices. It is the good offices of the African Union that I think are the most effective in trying to mediate and calm down conflicts. And so there have been examples in partnership with regional economic communities that the African Union has played a positive role. I think one thing of why the African Union is less effective now than it has been in the past is the creation of the African Union. You had a group of African leaders with strong pan-African vision and agency at that particular time. Thabo Mbeki, former President Wad, the late Bouteflika, President Kagame.
And Obasanjo as well from
and
Nigeria.
And Obasanjo, absolutely. And they did have a common vision. You know, there were some divisions among them, but they were locomotives for this thing. It's very difficult to actually give you a name of a pan-African visionary of that stature at the moment on the continent in that way.
So if young people today questioned whether or not the AU is relevant, what would you say?
Look, I think we're in a world where better collective action is important to deal with the global issues. And some of the big visions of which the African Union is meant to be helping to assist, for example, the African Free Continental Trade Area, breaking down boundaries and growing internal trade is absolutely, in my view, what the African continent needs to get the economic growth. So all your young listeners have better and productive jobs and live well and long. That's really important to get greater prosperity in the continent. So it's collective security, but it's also kind of collective trade and investment.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Audrey. It's always good to hear your voice.
It's lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. Ciao. See you. Bye-bye.
That's Alex Vines, head of the Africa program at Chatham House. I'm going to take you back to a time when northern Uganda was the theatre for a very vicious war that began in 1987. It was fought, ostensibly, between a group called the Lord's Resistance Army and the Ugandan People's Defence Forces. In actual fact, thousands of children were forcefully conscripted to fight that war. One of those children is on trial today in Uganda for at least 78 charges of murder, rape, and crimes against humanity. The Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, doesn't operate in Uganda anymore. It has spread to countries like the Central African Republic and the forests of the Democratic Republic of Congo, from where it commits brutal acts of violence against civilians. Uganda's army, the UPDF, was also accused of perpetrating acts of violence in that war in the north. Brigadier General Felix Kulaije speaks for the Ugandan army. I asked him, who is the man in the dock today and how did he end up there?
Thomas Kwelo was a commander within LRA. He was abducted earlier when he was young. He grew to become a commander and he himself participated in abductions of young people, girls and boys, whom they would eventually convert into combatants of the LRA. So he's accused of crimes against humanity by the Crimes Division of the Ugandan High Court.
Tell us about the Lord's Resistance Army. What did they want?
The LRA emerged after the defeat of Alice Lakwena, who, by the way, happened to have been a cousin to Joseph Kony, the leader of the LRA. Alice Lakwena had started a rebellion, claiming she had been inspired by a spirit called Lakwena in local language, and she was fighting against government. When she was defeated in eastern Uganda, her father took over briefly, and then her cousin, Joseph Kony, began what he called the Lord's Resistance Army, and the aim was to establish a rule based on Ten Commandments. He was at first supported by local individuals, but eventually they turned against him when he began mutilating their lips, ears, and killing. But sooner than later, he went into arms with the Bashir's government
in Sudan.
That armed him
in
Sudan, Khartoum, that armed him to fight Uganda government and also the SPLA that was fighting for the independence of South Sudan.
Right, so there was already a regional dimension to it.
Correct.
So the Ugandan army fought this insurgency. The army itself is accused of committing atrocities in Gulu and northern Uganda. So Dominic Ongwen is one of the LRA commanders, and he's the only one that's been charged and sentenced at the International Criminal Court. Thomas Kwelo is being charged locally. Why is that?
Well, I need you to understand why Dominic Ongwen was taken to ICC, because the best of my knowledge, the ICC would do be invoked if there is no local capacity or willingness to charge an individual. And like I've just mentioned, we have a crimes division in our high court that charges these criminals that have committed atrocities against the people. Now, about the accusations against the army, we have mechanisms that from time to time did put on trial anybody that erred from within our ranks.
And so have people from the army been charged and are they serving sentences for atrocities committed in northern Uganda?
Oh, yes. Others have even been executed publicly, because one of our ways of dealing with the question of discipline would be to make a public trial of anyone that could have killed a civilian and would try this individual in the area where he committed the crime. And if the sentence is death by a firing squad, would execute him before the family of the victims.
How many people from the army had been held to account for crimes committed in northern Uganda? Do you know?
Not offhand, but I can say confidently that before the sentence was suspended, we had executed 123 of our own for murder or rape, because those two crimes for us and the defilement carried a death sentence.
Hundreds of people who had been part of the LRA had been pardoned, had been reintegrated into the community. So why is Thomas Kwelo not one of those people?
Did you hear his accusation?
Yes.
He's accused of crimes against humanity. Actually, 98 crimes.
Yeah.
I don't know where you start from to pardon the individual. such crimes he committed.
But don't you think that other people, among those that had been pardoned, may very well face the same kinds of charges? I'm just wondering why specifically him, rather than just looking at the charges, because there are accusations that this is politically motivated. His argument is that he was also a child, and you mentioned that he was also abducted, and he was forced into the position that he found himself. So there should be some kind of leeway in understanding, because so many of the people that were in the LRA faced exactly the same conditions that he did.
A number of LRA commanders gave up rebellion and sought amnesty. Thomas Kwairo had the opportunities to do so, particularly during the peace talks of 1994, the peace talks of the late 90s, the peace talks of 2005. Unfortunately, he chose not to utilize the opportunities.
How was he apprehended?
He was captured in the Central African Republic in combat. After LRA had been given a chance to assemble in Winchibul, they didn't in South Sudan. Actually, first of all, DRC still had opportunity. He didn't. Went up to Central Africa. The peace talks were organized in 2005, 6, 7. Thomas Kwairo still remained a combatant, him and Dominic Ongwen and others. So when he was captured, we had no option but to charge him with the crimes he had committed.
Are there others to follow?
To the best of my knowledge, many returnees have been integrated, even as recent as December last year. We had a number of ex-LRA that have denounced rebellion already in Central Africa, with the assistance of the UN, been handed over to Uganda government. They have been rehabilitated and they are going to be reintegrated with their communities.
What's happening with the LRA now? You spoke about names that for many people who might have been listening to Focus on Africa over the years, Joseph Kony and Dominic Ongwen and Alice Lakwena, and even the name Lord's Resistance Army was very much part of one of the main stories covered in Africa in the last 20 years or so. Where is the LRA now and where is Joseph Kony now?
I do not know where Joseph Kony is. Some are saying he's in Kafia Kingi, which is in Sudan, and many combatants broke away from him. I've told you some have been returning. We have about 168 that have so far been facilitated to return with their families that ceased to work with him. I'm told his son has become the dominant commander as of now. I don't know commanding who. So since he's outside the country and we are not in Central Africa or Sudan, I can't tell what's happening about them now.
So they're not a problem for Uganda anymore. Is that what you're saying?
Not at all. They are not a problem anymore. Northern Uganda has since gone back to full production. Gulu is now a full city that is thriving. Trade is going on between Northern Uganda and South Sudan and the rest of the country. So LRA is no longer a factor.
Thomas Kwairo said that he was a child soldier. He was abducted at the age of 12 while he was walking to school. Is that for you a strong enough defense? Do you see that 12-year-old child being abducted and being forced into becoming a commander and commanding these frightful, horrific atrocities on the people of Uganda? Is there a measure, in a way, of understanding for what he went through? Because it also does embody, doesn't it, what happened to children in northern Uganda?
I do appreciate what certainly happened to him at the very start. But like I've said, there were several opportunities for Kwairo to escape, like others did. People like Banya, person who was spokesperson of LRA, did escape and handed themselves over during peace talks. Thomas Kwairo, even during peace talks, was busy raining havoc on the civilian population. So he had a chance to indeed surrender and be rehabilitated as a next child soldier. Unfortunately, he instead enjoyed commanding some of these crimes that were being meted out.
Brigadier General Felix Kulaije speaking on behalf of the Ugandan Army. We're moving to Zambia now, and some good news concerning a treatment to help fight the spread of HIV infections. It's an epidemic we don't talk about much anymore, but it is still a major issue among young people especially. So Zambia has become the second country in the world to roll out an injectable prevention drug called PrEP. The only other country that has done this as part of a national public health initiative is the United States. Experts hope that injectable PrEP will be more widely used than PrEP in pill form. That was rolled out in 2015, and it didn't work too well. So there are high hopes for the injection. But what is PrEP? How does it work? And most importantly, is it a game changer in the fight against HIV? These and other questions were answered by Dr. Suilanji Sivile, an infectious diseases expert in Zambia's health ministry.
So for what we are doing in Zambia, this is public health rollout of the injectable PrEP. But we do have results from clinical trial that we've based this evidence. This clinical trial was done in partially South Africa, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Kenya, and Uganda. For Zambia, we are rolling it out in the public health sector. The result for the trial was that the injectable PrEP was 80% better than the oral PrEP.
And why was that?
So typically, for oral PrEP to be effective, you need to take it every day, or you do have a variant where you take a certain number of doses before you have contact. So there is some trouble with adherence to drugs. For the injectable, it kind of sorts out that problem because you don't have to take the drugs every day. So it tends to be better because this particular injection, you actually take it twice every after 2 months.
Every 2 months you have the injectable, whereas with the pill, you had to take it every day, you had to remember to take it every day. Are there side effects to PrEP?
Like any other drugs, side effects are there, but they are minimal, especially that the people who are taking these drugs are usually health people. So for the injectables, the main side effects really is the pain on the injection site. There's a bit of worry for individuals who have liver disease, but that's not a contraindication as such.
Now, I know from reporting on AIDS and AIDS treatments and HIV infections and how people regard them when they have them, adherence to taking drugs or just coming out and saying that you are infected in that way, this thing that people call stigma, is part of the reason why perhaps uptake of the pills associated or the PrEP as an oral treatment or prophylaxis and the injectable is part of the reason why the injectable is more successful. The fact that you don't have those pills and you go to the doctor or whatever, and you can conceal in a way the fact that you are taking this treatment.
You are spot on that, Audrey. Yes. So you do have that privacy. There are a number of people who would not like their sexual partners to know that they are on PrEP. So once you get the jab in the hospital, nobody will know that you're not on PrEP. As opposed to taking the pills, people are afraid that they can be found in the house or in the bag, that sort of thing. Yeah. So stigma is a big issue.
Why is stigma still such a big issue concerning HIV and the treatment of it?
Well, part of the reason is how the disease is spread. Some people feel, you know, linked to behavior that is probably not acceptable in some of our societies. But there's a lot of work that has gone on throughout the continent, such that recent studies, for instance, that we've done in Zambia shows that actually stigma does go down. But the main issue is the pathway of the spread of the disease that is really sexually.
And let's iron out exactly who can take PrEP. If somebody is already HIV positive, can they use injectable PrEP or PrEP in pill form as a form of treatment? Or is it strictly before you are actually infected as a way of stopping yourself from being infected?
Yeah, so it's strictly before you get infected. So PrEP is just for prevention and not for treatment.
And it's not just for anybody, is it? You can't just take it.
Yeah, so the main reason is that you are at risk of getting the infection. And so in most of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, especially the East and Southern Africa, the whole population do meet the threshold of being at a higher risk. But we do pick individuals that maybe they are discordant couples or they have multiple sexual partners that are involved in transactional sex, or maybe they have a partner that they actually do not know their HIV status, or their partner is at a higher risk of getting HIV. So those kind of situations.
And how do you actually get a prescription for PrEP? Can anybody go into a clinic or a hospital and say, I'd like PrEP, or do you need to actually pass a particular threshold.
Anybody who perceives themselves to be at a higher risk of HIV infection is at liberty to visit a health facility. Like here in Zambia, PrEP is provided free. Oral PrEP, you can get it even from the pharmacy. But for the injectables, as you know, because, you know, the environment has to be sterile, so it has to be done in a health facility to prevent infections and by a trained person because it's that invasive.
So tell us why Zambia became the first site in Africa to actually make injectable PrEP available. Other countries have yet to do it, and the only other country that does it is America.
Our program is slightly ambitious and advanced, and obviously we do have a big problem with new infections. As I speak, for 2023, our estimates were at 30,000 new infections per year, so which is slightly higher than a lot of our neighbors. But also, we do have the infrastructure to handle that kind of intervention.
And do you know when other countries in Africa will roll out injectable PrEP in the way that you've done? What do they need to be able to do it?
Most of the countries that have similar epidemics like ours, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Uganda, Botswana, I think they are ready. It's just there's been some challenges with the supply chain. But I know before the end of the year, most of these countries should receive this intervention.
Just give us an idea of the, you called it an epidemic. Are we still talking about an HIV epidemic? Is it still as frightening and as fatal in a way as it was 20 years ago or so?
So the epidemic is still with us. As you know, 80% of people living with HIV are in our region, that Eastern Southern Africa.
80% of people in the world?
In the world, that's right. Still within okay. us. It's a big problem. Though in this part of the world, there's a bit of control. You know, we use the UNAIDS 95-95. I know a couple of countries have advanced towards achieving that, but AIDS is spilling over again in other places, say Eastern Europe, where the incidence is still going.
What kind of impact are you hoping that the introduction of the injectable PrEP will have in Zambia?
Our new infections are more common among the young people, 15 to 24. We've really, you know, laser focused this intervention for that particular population. We hope that in the next few years, we'll see the new infections drastically dropping in that population. And that's the impact that we're really looking for.
So you're hoping that PrEP will help you do that?
Sure.
And the injectable PrEP specifically?
Injectable PrEP, yeah, that's our focus with this intervention, to give young people 15 to 24, especially adolescent girls.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Sulianji Sivile, an infectious diseases expert in Zambia's Ministry of Health. Bella Hassan, Stefania Okereke and Rob Wilson were hard at work on the program here in London. Richard Kagoe did his bit from Nairobi. Sunita Nahar supervised our efforts. Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Alice Mudengi and Andre Lombard are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time here on Focus on Africa.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down.
I don't think we realized what the true flavor of Wyoming was back in 1969.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
There was a rebel Confederate flag being flown.
It was different. It was definitely different.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.